Welcome to On Defense and Security, a podcast that examines domestic and international defense and military affairs. Through conversations, we will bridge the gap between academic research and policy and provide a platform for informed discussions, enabling our listeners to better understand critical issues.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yolan Buka, and I'm an assistant professor at Queen's University in the Department of Political Studies. And I teach gender and international relations and race and politics in Africa. So today I have the pleasure of hosting our guest, Dr. Jessica Achter, who is a chair of Chaire de Recherche on Visual Culture and International Studies. At Université Laval in Quebec, in Canada. And I'm particularly excited to be in conversation with her today. So her research is situated within the kind of critical security studies and focusing on visual politics. And the topic of our conversation today will be on her work related to her recent book that she published in 2021, called Global Corpse Politics, the Obscenity Taboo. And so welcome to the show, Jessica. I will call you Jessica. We worked together on other projects. I'm really excited to talk with her. And so welcome. And
thank you so much for having me today.
Yes.
Excited for this conversation.
Absolutely. So first, can you give us a brief summary of your book and like what your book is about?
Certainly. I think my background is in the post-atrocity context. And sort of my past research has been on memory and memorialization, a post-genocide sort of context, and the work of artists in memory projects. And I think in doing that work, I started thinking a lot about the role of images in representing atrocity, the role of images and how we understand global politics. And I also started to kind of observe a lot of events around me, like the death of Muammar Gaddafi and other sorts of the ISIS beheading images, and also the general context of humanitarian images. And I started to observe certain kind of trends in the way that dead body images were published. And that was the kind of the origins of that book, was this kind of puzzle about when dead bodies images were published and when they were restricted, when viewers were instructed to look at these images, and when we were told we shouldn't look at them because they were too horrifying. So that's how I began with the project, with some of these questions on the role of dead body images and the regulation of dead body images. And from there, I started thinking a lot about the functioning of what I call the obscenity taboo, which is the labeling of particular images as obscene as a mechanism of sort of regulation, as a form of politics, that the decision on what counts as obscene isn't something that's objective, but rather something that is political and can tell us a lot about how certain political communities function, about how identities are constructed. And I also thought it isn't as simple as this sort of formula that dead body images of enemies are shown and our dead body images aren't, but rather it was a much more complicated relationship of certain things becoming hyper-visible, certain things being rendered invisible, and also the mechanisms of regulation for a lot of these images, like trigger warnings and other sorts of things like that. So that's the sort of questions that I sought to address in the project. But there's a whole list of other questions that kind of came out afterwards about how we represent atrocity more broadly and the role of other actors like practitioners. So there's still a lot to be investigating.
Yes, and I know that you are starting a new project on the ways in which journalists work through the role of journalists in these kinds of dynamics as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, one thing that I realized was that there's a lot of work that's been done on image circulation, but less research on image production. And some of the dynamics of the people that are making everyday decisions about what images actually get circulated in a human rights context. So I'm interested in the work of journalists as professional witnesses and some of the trauma that they experience being embedded in the context that they're embedded in. I'm also interested in the work of activists and artists, even forensic anthropologists, people that are encountering these sorts of human rights violations on an everyday basis and making decisions about how to visually represent them to broader audiences. So I think there's something interesting to be explored in the dynamics of practitioners who are working with the visual representation of atrocity, and also in the in some of the dynamics of how they manage themselves the trauma of the proximity to atrocity, which is also a question for scholars as well, that we struggle with. Anyone that works on human suffering, human rights violations, or any of these contexts of political violence deals with a lot of these same questions that many of these what I call professional witnesses are also navigating. So there's a lot of questions that emerge out of a focus on dead body images that can be applied more broadly to this context of atrocity or how we represent or understand atrocity.
So I want us to actually follow this thread of the challenges and the ethics of doing this kind of work. But before I do that, I'd like to know where you situate yourself in your scholarship. Because in the discipline, what do you call yourself? What do you study? Are you an IR scholar? Are you a humanities? I mean, I know you're in international studies, right? But how do you do this work of the visual in a field that it seems to not be so concerned about images and ethics of whose bodies we show and whose we don't? And which ones we focus on, how do you situate yourself in the broader discipline?
This is such a great question and one that I've spent a lot of time thinking about over the years. I think from the very beginning, when I started pursuing my study in graduate school, I felt like a sort of fish out of water. I always felt as though I never really had a home. And my advisor in graduate school, my PhD advisor, Roxanne Doty, is well known for her work on migration border politics, but also her later work on storytelling and the connections between storytelling and methodology. She said something that has always stuck with me since, which is you have to write for the people that your audience isn't an audience of academics. It's also, you know, the people that she was talking to when she visited border sites, migrants and that sort of thing. That was her audience as well. The people that worked for humanitarian organizations that were working in border areas, that was her audience as well. And so I think that has stuck with me ever since then, but has also made it quite difficult for me to situate myself in any kind of disciplinary home. The advantage of my position at Université Laval is that it's a multidisciplinary position in a graduate school of international studies. So the exciting thing about that is that I don't have to pinpoint myself as being associated with a specific discipline. I get to really focus on investigating these types of questions from the center of the questions themselves. Right. You know, there's always the practical considerations of where you publish your work and to what audience. But I tend to consider myself a critical security studies scholar because I think at the end of the day, I'm interested in questions about how we understand a lot of the concepts that are at the heart of sort of security, which are identity and violence, but perhaps not understood in traditional senses of those terms. And I consider myself a critical scholar because I tend to focus on excavating the assumptions at the heart of how we understand the global or the international. So my background, it originates in politics, but I think that's overly limiting to fully investigate all of the questions that I'm engaged in. So it's a non-answer.
No, it's a lovely answer
about situatedness. But I do think that it is often a struggle to think about how we engage in certain types of methodology, given that methodology is often so closely linked to the boundaries of specific disciplines. So I'm lucky in that I have the freedom to kind of push beyond that. But I would encourage anyone, regardless of their disciplinary home, to consider how their research can be question driven, and how they can push the boundaries of kind of whatever methodology has been imposed on them by their disciplines, and to pursue questioning in the form of narrative work, ethnographic work, visual analysis, and those sorts of things. So those are the types of methods that I rely on under this kind of broad umbrella of interpretive work. But I think that, yes, it necessitates an interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary orientation for sure, as you articulated.
So I want to go back to this issue of ethics, of doing the kind of work that you're doing. And I particularly like your first chapter in your book, when you're this little anecdote that you open with, where you are looking at images, I think it's in Syria, yeah?
Syria.
And you're looking at the images, but you're trying to document and keep a record. And then you press print, and then you're realizing that somebody could get to the printer in your department before you and then be exposed to these images. And then you're screaming, "Don't look at what's in the front coming out of the printer," which I thought was hilarious. but, you know, so that kind of reaction that you have when you're printing these images, I'm assuming comes from an understanding of some of the challenges and the risks and the difficulties dealing with such graphic realities of what people go through. And one question that I have is that you were concerned about other people looking at these images without knowing, at the printer. How do you manage the work? How do you manage to do this work in a way that first considers the ethical responsibilities of care with the images and how you analyze them? And secondly, how do you remain human as you're looking at images of dehumanization on a relatively regular basis?
Yes, this is such an excellent question. And it's a question that I'm frequently asked by students also, because, I teach on the same subjects, atrocity, sexual violence. So all of my research is on, visual representation of atrocity, death, genocide, sexual violence, these sorts of themes. So I'm often asked, how do I maintain my sort of happy persona in the face of all of this also? So I think, first of all, it's an excellent question. It's a question that recurs frequently for me, partly because I think because I'm so interested in these kind of images of atrocity, I begin with a sort of deep theoretical understanding of this protective impulse that we often have, which is what drove my desire to ensure no one saw these images in a printer before I had a chance to get to them. And so I think that often we have this protective impulse at play, that people should only encounter this kind of graphicness in the right situation. But what is the right situation? And I think we often understand the existence of certain privileged witnesses, perhaps journalists, war reporters, photojournalists, or something like that, perhaps human rights organization, people who work for human rights organizations, or forensic anthropologists dealing with mass grave sites, or scholars. And I think that we often consider ourselves to live in a category as privileged witnesses who are able to encounter objectively all of these sorts of horrible things and maintain our scholarly objectivity. But at the end of the day, we are human beings who have emotional responses. And I think having done some fieldwork in Rwanda at genocide memorial sites and talking to some survivors there, I think that's when it really drove home for me the fact that I was not an objective scholar. And even though I may have known a lot more about the Rwanda genocide than many other visitors to memorial sites, due to my research, and even though I may have had scholarly questions that I was there to investigate, I was also a human being that would inevitably have an emotional response to someone speaking with me who felt traumatized by recounting their story, or to seeing dead bodies on display at a genocide memorial site. So I think the first sort of piece of advice that I would have for scholars engaging this kind of work that I've learned over the years is not to deny our own humanity. And I think many people who engage in this type of scholarship do so because of particular pieces of their own personal history that connect them to these sorts of topics. It doesn't necessarily mean that they themselves are a victim of violence or come from a country of origin that has been the subject of violence. It could be It could be something a lot less sort of direct, but I think we don't ask our questions out of nowhere. Right. Our research interests don't develop out of thin air. Our research interests develop out of something that is internal and personal to us. And to deny that and to claim that the only thing that matters is scholarly objectivity is a denial of the reality that we're human beings who feel something when we encounter human suffering. And those feelings are quite complex. So one thing that I really struggled with a lot when I was engaging with this book is how to do justice to the individual lives and deaths that I was speaking about. How do you navigate scholarly analysis of these cases while also acknowledging that these are people who had complex and rich lives and family members and complicated deaths often, and family members that mourn them? And I think that I struggled a lot, but I also tried really hard to maintain that in my mind at all times, that I was not talking about data. I was talking about human lives, even if I didn't know the person's name, even if it was a collection of mass deaths, even if it was a noted terrorist. At the end of the day, I was talking about human beings. And so I think it's important to think about these types of questions of human dignity, even in the most undignified sets of circumstances. And we often think about death as being one of the most undignified things. And that's partly why there are all these regulations about when we should or shouldn't look at dead body images. That's why we have this taboo surrounding dead body images, is because the dead human body is sacred. And, you know, you shouldn't look at it as a matter of dignity, except in these exceptional circumstances. And that's why I was so interested in what these exceptional circumstances were and what they mean for how we understand these questions of human dignity. But from a personal perspective, for me, I really had to navigate the difficulty I had in encountering repeatedly these images of, you know, torture victims and death. And I did have nightmares about, you know, the images I had seen of Syrian torture victims. And I had to put in place certain practices, like not doing any work before I went to sleep and all these other. I mean, I think there are very real practical things we can do as scholars at the end of the day for our own mental health. It's one reason also why I'm interested in the practice of journalists. Yeah. And there's been recent attention to journalist trauma, because journalists, like academics in many cases, become embedded in communities. They become embedded in the communities they report on. Whether they are reporting on a school shooting or on a conflict, they become embedded in those communities, even if just for a short time. And they become proximate to victims' family members, to their stories, as a mechanism of their reporting. But that also enhances the trauma that they may feel. But there's also, like in academia, this idea like, well, you should have a stiff upper lip. Mm-hmm. You're objective. You're just there to convey the truth. As with scholars, you're just there to convey data. But I think that it is more useful to move beyond this idea that we should be turning human beings into data, and instead thinking about how we as scholars, as well as all these other practitioners that are engaged in many of the same types of work, are embedded in the production of certain understandings about the people that we're discussing. That I, as a scholar who is sort of engaging in this analysis, I'm choosing certain lives, voices, deaths to elevate, and others not to. And at the very least, I should be conscious and transparent about those choices, mm-hmm. and attempt to do so in a way that dignifies the human beings that are part of that story. It's my story, but it's also their story. And I can't tell their story for them. But at the same time, I am a voice that is tracing a piece of their story. And it's a complicated ethical set of circumstances to be in. It's a complicated methodological set of circumstances to be in. And I don't necessarily see those things as separate from one another, the ethical stance and the methodological stance. And I think that's one reason why I see storytelling methodology, narrative and interpretive methodology as so useful, because you're able to live in the reality of your own scholarship, your own emotion, perhaps your own trauma, your own encounters with this atrocity, while you're also engaging some of these complex scholarly questions.
So Catherine McKittrick, who's a professor here at Queen's, talks about, how we maintain an ethical distance between ourselves and while remaining aware of our humanity the necessity of keeping an ethical distance between the subject of inquiry, particularly when it comes to violence. And she's particularly talking about, Black Death. And so one of the questions that I have for you, as you're talking about kind of this, the relationship between yourself as a human being and the work that you do, is as you're thinking through and analyzing the data, I do particularly work on experiences of violence as opposed to images. One of the challenging things that comes is this issue of consent, right? So I can often get consent from the people that I interview and try to at the same time recognize the impact of the research on myself, but there's idea that I kind of constantly maintain this ethical distance by first not pretending I understand more than I actually do, you know, following up with questions, sometimes interviewing a person more than once, maintaining this idea that at any part of the research, they can withdraw consent, which in the case of looking at images, it's quite different because these are people who are not only victims, but they're images of these individuals, often who've been on display without their consent to begin with. And so how do you navigate this issue of consent and distance and reflection about how you tell the story in a context where you can't actually get consent from the person whose story has already been shared or hidden or disclosed to the public?
Yeah, this is such a fantastic question. This is something I also think about quite a lot. I think, often images of atrocity are circulated under the justification that they provide evidence of a reality that we shouldn't deny exists, a human rights violation. And that evidentiary justification sort of supersedes a lot of what are considered sort of ethical concerns and the dilemmas of consent and all of that. So I think it's interesting because when you're engaged in image analysis of media images, as I was in the book project, largely media images, a few other sort of contexts, but largely media images, you're talking about images that have already been fairly widely disseminated and are already fairly ethically fraught. I think that I try to acknowledge the ethical dilemmas that already exist in that circulation. And if I personally feel as though there is an issue with the way in which these images were circulated, I do everything I can not to replicate those same issues. So sometimes that may be choosing not to publish an image myself in my research, choosing not to show an image in one of my classes or something along those lines. So it can be something fairly easy like that. In other cases, I think precisely because images may have been disseminated without much critical assessment of these ethical dilemmas, the onus is on us as scholars to engage in critique of these processes of production and dissemination. But I do think that as with field work, as you mentioned, that, when you're engaged with survivors of violence or something along those lines, the scholar can always leave the context. And it is the same thing with images. I can always choose to walk away. And the individuals depicted in those images can't choose to no longer be part of those images that have been circulated. And they also can't choose to not be part of the processes of violence that sort of led them to that outcome of death, and then death that can be depicted in particular ways. So for me, I think if we can get at some of the processes by which these deaths are not only justified, but also able to be rendered visible, then that allows us to sort of better understand some of the processes of commodification of these lives and deaths that are existing all around us. So if we can have a more critical eye at the images that we're kind of continually barraged with, including, you know, humanitarian campaigns, there's a whole host of them, then we can better understand the justifications being given and assess whether we buy into them or not. And in my case, you know, I often suggest we shouldn't buy into them, or that we should consider more critically, at least, the relationship between images that are allowed to be shown and bodies that are allowed to be killed, or deaths that we consider to be normal, and the normalization of particular deaths in particular places. I have some previous work I've done on what I call quiet deaths in the global south, which is this sort of idea that in some places, death is just considered to be normal, and public grieving is sort of deemed primitive and distant from the kind of like privatized grieving that exists in places where violence isn't normal. And that can have really pernicious and insidious impacts on how we understand on how we understand particular instances of violence, but also violence more generally. But there's also more to it. And I think there is, from an ethical and methodological perspective, there is a rule I always follow, which is that if you can get information without engaging individuals directly in their own trauma, you should do so. So I think in our discipline, in international studies, in international relations, in politics, there's often this notion that you have to be there on the ground seeing what's happening. It gives you street cred. Right. It gives you legitimacy without much attention to the fact that there may have been 10 other scholars interviewing exactly those same individuals, maybe asking slightly different questions, but still. So I think that don't repeat work that's already done just to give yourself this supposed sort of street cred of being proximate to individuals and their trauma. And I think the same thing with images. I think about many of the same things. If you don't need to show an image in order to analyze the conditions of its production and dissemination, then don't. Right. If you don't need to replicate commodification that may have existed in a certain context, then don't, for your own purposes. And it sounds fairly easy, but in some ways I have the luxury of being a more senior scholar who doesn't have to worry as much about the some of the practical dynamics of publishing for tenure and some of the demands that are often placed on junior scholars in particular, graduate students in particular, to establish firmly their legitimacy as scholars. So I think it's actually a huge problem for anyone who's interested in global issues, is that we give so much credit to this kind of primary source dynamic. Not to suggest that primary sources aren't useful, they are for sure in many contexts, but just to say that my personal thoughts on this are that we should advocate a bit more thoughtfulness in the way we understand legitimate sources for understanding the everyday experiences and stories of people who have experienced violence.
So I think one of the things that I find interesting about your work is because I've thought about images myself, probably because like many of the people who are going to be listening to this podcast, but just in general, we're in this era of rapid dissemination of information through technology and social media. And over the past 2 years, I've had a lot of questions about which bodies are consumable and which ones aren't deemed consumable. And I think one of the most striking example was the terrorist attack in Garissa in Kenya a few years ago at the university. What we saw on the front pages of newspapers and media information were, you know, bodies, you know, of students who had been shot. I think it was I don't know if it was a cafeteria or a public space at the university, dead students, really kind of just a picture front page, and people having questions about whether or not that was justified, considering the fact that, for example, a few years before you had the Boston Marathon attack, where while some bodies were displayed, many of these images were eventually removed, or the only ways in which some of these images were displayed was when bodies were already covered. So as you were, as you're working, and I know, you know, you probably didn't study these particular cases, but I cannot help but think about the racial dynamic, the global racial dynamics of victimhood, and who's considered a victim, but whose bodies are deemed acceptable to display. So I'm trying to kind of link your past research and your underlying projects, and I was wondering whether, I'm sure you do, what are your thoughts on that? Because I find this particular angle particularly interesting.
I mean, I think you're so right. This is something that's heavily racialized, and it's also heavily gendered. I think partly because we associate vulnerability and victimhood with racialized and gendered ideas. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, there are certain individuals that are considered more sort of worthy victims. But also, as you mentioned, we live in this era of, you know, social media, image overload, and these sorts of dynamics, to the extent that victims often have to present their own suffering to the world in ways that render their suffering qualified for help, intervention, what have you, or attention, awareness. And so I think there are some issues with that idea of kind of external intervention and white savior complex. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I think we often exist in this environment of competitive suffering, where victims are forced to present their suffering as shocking as possible in the public sphere in order to receive attention to it. But there is already in place a hierarchy of whose suffering matters more. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is foreignness, sometimes it's sort of racialized as well. Sometimes it's this sort of idea of women and children, mm-hmm. which is a theme that we often see in humanitarian discourse, that vulnerability looks a certain way, and certain kinds of vulnerability are more likely to draw in donations. We see religious iconography in humanitarian discourse as well, like the Madonna and child. These sorts of themes recur. But to speak more directly to this idea of how this is racialized that you mentioned, I think there's been a lot of attention to this recently as a result of the police perpetrated violence in the U.S. Yeah. In certain communities. And it's something that I've thought a lot about, because many of these cases occurred as I was kind of like working on the book and finishing the book. And it's interesting because a lot of people are suggesting that these images that are circulating of Black bodies, dead Black bodies, are often akin to lynching photographs in the way that they're being shared and circulated, and in a way that's quite undignified. But on the other hand, you also have the idea that in many of these cases, if you didn't have someone there taking videos and posting them on the internet, you wouldn't have necessarily had judicial accountability or attempts at judicial accountability. So there's a tension at play here. Certainly, again, in this idea that suffering must be presented in order to justify itself. And I think that's particularly true of Black bodies in particular contexts, that they have to present their suffering as fitting a certain type of suffering for it to reach the sort of level of attention, accountability, and these sort of dynamics. And you also see a different sort of reckoning with school shooting photographs in the U.S., mm-hmm. where news reporters are trying to navigate how much they should be showing. And a lot of people are starting to suggest that we should show more photos of dead kids in school shootings, because it really drives home the reality of what has happened. So for me, I'm quite interested in this connection between photographic documentation and our understanding of what counts as real, especially when you have forms of violence that are so extreme that they seem unreal to us, or they shouldn't be real, like extreme human rights violations. And I think it also goes back to the normalization of particular kinds of violence, that there's a long history in the West, and particularly in the United States, of violence against Black bodies and of obscene photographs like lynching photographs. So I think there's always a history and a context to images that circulate. So when you look at images of police brutality or something along those lines in a contemporary American context, you can't deny the history that exists through which people encounter these images, which is this kind of long history. It's the same way that it's very difficult to examine images of human rights violations or genocide in a contemporary context without having analogies to the Holocaust mm-hmm. and to concentration camp images and those sorts of things. So I think there become certain iconic images that structure the way that we understand certain ideas. It structures the way we understand what violence is, and it structures the way we understand what suffering looks like. Mm-hmm. And so this long history of lynching photographs that sort of normalized the commodification of dead Black bodies in the United States, you can't ignore that when you also look at the contemporary circulation and the ease with which these images often circulates. Right. So I think there's also the question of, like, are dead body images and should dead body images be circulated in a more solemn manner? And what does that look like in the era of contemporary social media sharing?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very difficult to convey that sense of solemnity or sacredness associated with certain types of death or suffering. So I don't have the answer to this, but I think it's a big dilemma for the impact that social media has on how we consume images, because of this potential inability to convey sacredness, the sober sort of encounters with it, the solemnity that perhaps should be attributed to many of these images, as opposed to the sort of it went viral kind of phenomenon. So it's a lingering dilemma.
Yeah. I think for me, there's also a question of permissibility. You know, which communities are permissible to expose and which ones are treated with more respect. I think you speak to this kind of long history of particular types of images that have already been normalized in public consumptions even before the advent of social media. And this permissibility of displaying particular, you know, dead bodies of people, because of a particular hierarchy, it's like showing, you know, less human individuals. So you know, I've really been puzzled with this question of which images are permissible to display, not only in terms of how they're used and instrumentalized for particular objectives and messaging, but also in terms of which ones are too sacred to show. So when you're talking about gun violence and children, you know, if you put context aside in terms of Garissa and other places, Garissa is, you know, it's a mass shooting that is contextualized in under the umbrella of the Global War Against Terror, the Terrorist Act, but at the same time, it's students who went to school and were gunned down, right? So they're victims of gun violence, but in the context of, you know, shootings at Virginia Tech or other places, there's a sense of sacredness and it's almost unauthorized.
Yes, certain violence is more illegitimate than other violence. Mm-hmm. And I think it is interesting to think about how certain war horrors are more normalized than others. Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk a little bit about this with regards to beheadings. Mm-hmm. And I think about this through the story of an Iraqi man who had worked with the Americans that was beheaded, and also ISIS beheadings. And I kind of like think through this idea of which severed heads become the sort of icons of horror, and which are just part of the everyday horrors of war that become sort of more accepted. And as you said, I think, you know, one thing I found really interesting in kind of looking at all these sorts of images is the idea that it often recurs that the human body is sacred. Mm-hmm. In almost every reporting of where there is a dead body image, there is this discussion of sort of dignity, but it is often set aside in the service of these kind of other aims. And that's why I'm so interested in this idea that suffering bodies must present themselves to the global public in order to be taken account of. If we look at the origins of humanitarian images of atrocity, one of the first humanitarian images ever is the image of a man in Belgian Congo whose daughter was killed and body was chopped up. And he's sitting next to the sort of severed body parts of his daughter. And it's sort of this, like, no one would believe his story unless he brought the parts themselves. And I think it's interesting in that context that now we see the same type of thing with images. Unless you have exactly the right image that is deemed to be documenting that atrocity appropriately, you won't have the kind of sort of attention or acknowledgement that this is a form of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something important here about the politics of awareness and the politics of kind of acknowledgement, but acknowledgement only of the right kind of violence. But it all goes back to this association we have of photographs as real, photographs yeah. as truth, which itself is really a fraught idea that that is a lot more complicated than that. And in the book, I talk a little about the dilemma of photographs as evidence and some of the kind of dynamics under which that operates in a contemporary media context. Mm-hmm. But I think we still assume that that relationship exists. So you have to present your suffering, and you better present it with a picture, because a picture is worth a thousand words. All these sort of understandings we have about photographs.
Mm-hmm. So that brings me then to a question of the believability of victims, right? Do we need in the work that you've done and that you're continuing to do, is a testimony not sufficient in the context of mass atrocities or extraordinary violence? And I'm going to ask that, but I also want to ask you, have you had a chance to read Leanne Fugee's Showtime?
Yeah.
So I want to keep that in the back, because I'd like to see, you know, what you think about her work that was published recently after her passing, and whether you see connections between her work and your work. But let's stick with this idea of believability of victims, particularly in the context of mass and atrocious violence. Do you feel like as you've been doing this work, that we actually need to see, to believe, or is it because of some sort of geographical or racial distance or cultural distance or an international distance that we need to see to be motivated to act? And does it work?
Yeah, this is such a great question. Several years ago, I was working on the final revisions for a paper that became my article, Border Monuments, which was published in the Review of International Studies. And in that paper, I talk about human remains of migrants that were in the desert between the U.S. and Mexico in the Arizona desert. And I talk a little bit about how even undiscovered, those remains are political, have important political implications. And I received a lot of pushback, actually, from reviewers on the piece who said, if the remains are undiscovered, they're not political. And that has stuck with me quite a lot as I think about these questions of visibility, mm-hmm. That visibility is considered a precondition for qualified political participation. I really think that that is the case, that and I have huge issues with it, but I think that global politics functions on the assumption that that's in order for something to be political, it must be visible. And I also think that global politics functions with a bias against the witness accounts and against testimonies, because witness accounts can be biased, but photographs are truth, or at least that's the assumption that's being made. And I think there's a huge issue with this in the human rights context, is that victims' voices are often silenced in a whole host of mechanisms, like transitional justice mechanisms even, and that sort of thing. They're silenced in favor of evidence, scientific procedures, right. All of these things, of which photographs can be a part, but are not necessarily the only thing. And there's been some anthropologists that have found that in many communities where you see atrocity, mass graves, et cetera, that you see external intervention that favors forensic excavation of grave sites.
Yeah.
But the local communities really don't, they wouldn't choose that. They prefer increased attention to witness accounts, increased attention to testimonies. So I think there's an important question here about which voices are being elevated. Mm-hmm. And when we consider visibility as a precondition for qualified political participation, which voices does that elevate and which voices does that silence? It makes it a lot easier for someone that's social media savvy, like Volodymyr Zelensky, who's excellent at using social media imagery and all of that,
yes,
to elevate that issue to the global agenda, than it is for a whole host of other contexts where there may be ongoing violence or atrocity or something like that, but less access to the forms of visual representation that are considered legitimate or viable in global politics. So I think, yes, seeing is believing, but I'm not okay with that. No, I have a lot of problems with that.
I love that. Like, I think qualified political participation. Is that how you qualify political participation? Is that how you...
Yeah, that visibility is a precondition for qualified political participation.
I'm going to quote that somewhere. I love that.
And I think my first book, which came out in 2012, was called The Politics of Haunting and Memory in International Relations.
Mm-hmm.
On memorial sites,
right.
And I thought a lot about this, and I kind of probed this idea of the ghostly, mm-hmm, in international politics, the things that haunt us, but also the ghostly, this thing that sort of resides in between the visible and the invisible, to kind of think through this idea of the ways in which visibility is a precondition for qualified political participation. So I've been working on this issue from a lot of different perspectives for quite some time, from ghosts to dead body images. It runs the gamut.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Thank you. This is actually really insightful. So let me hear about whether, like, some of the connections that you found, or that between your work and Leanne's recent book. Leanne Fujisa was a political scientist at University of Toronto, who unfortunately passed a few years ago, but her book came out where she compares, I think, the Balkans and lynchings in Maryland. What were your insights from that book?
And
how do you read your work in conversation with Leanne's work?
I think so. First, I'll just say that I knew Leanne personally through, she came to the International Studies Association Northeast Conference the year that I was program chair to give the keynote luncheon, yeah, lecture. And she gave an amazing lecture that was later published online on race issues in the discipline and diversity issues in the discipline. So I have so much respect for the impact that she made on the discipline more broadly. Mm-hmm. But I also think she was just an excellent human rights scholar all around. And a lot of her work focuses on this issue of performance and spectacle in the context of human rights violations. So I think she has worked for quite a long time on this sort of issue of how, not necessarily just images, mm-hmm, but performance sort of more broadly,
right,
forms an integral part of not only how perpetrators may engage in human rights violations, but also how human rights violations themselves become defined to the larger international community. So I think I see a lot of, as someone who's interested in kind of like what counts as a spectacle, mm-hmm, and what becomes a spectacle, I think that there's a lot of interesting connections there. I also think that a lot of people are working on these questions in the context of human rights without necessarily defining them as questions of visuality, as questions of visual politics, or questions of representation.
Mm-hmm.
That people are struggling a lot with awareness of atrocity, all these sorts of things, and they may not necessarily be using the language of spectacle or performance or visual representation, but it's something that is embedded in a lot of scholarship,
mm-hmm,
at least in a sort of an implicit way. And I find that quite interesting, given that visual analysis approaches are something that's relatively new or are relatively recently being adopted by a lot of different disciplines, but particularly by disciplines that are interested in international issues. So I think there's a lot more room to kind of think about the usefulness of those approaches and the usefulness of that, of that sort of language. It's one aim of the of my chaire de recherche,
mm-hmm,
in visual culture and international studies at University Laval, is to kind of start bringing together some more of these conversations about visual representation, about visual culture, to connect practitioners and scholars but also to connect communities of scholars that are working on on a lot of these questions and issues from different perspectives.
Yeah, I think it's the research is timely, and the share is timely as well, given how much social media has changed. I mean, there's a continuity, obviously, and you've mentioned it, a continuity. It's nothing new, but the intensification and the changes in dynamics and even the ways in which politics and diplomacy takes place in the public and in the social media sphere, I think definitely changes how these practices are used. And finally, that's the last question, so I don't take all of your time this afternoon. I'd like to know, what has been the most surprising thing for you as you've engaged in this research, whether it's about you or about the work that you're doing or about the findings? When you think about visual representation in politics, visual representation or of atrocities and mass violence, what has been the most one or two, maybe three, of the most kind of aha moments for you? I'd love to hear about that from you.
Yeah, that's such an excellent question. This is a question maybe we should be asking ourselves more frequently as we as we conduct our research. I think the first thing that has emerged from a lot of the connected different research that we've been talking about today that was perhaps maybe not the most surprising, but one of the most interesting or productive things is connecting with some of my own biases in a lot of these areas. And just thinking about why I choose the subject areas that I do, why I choose the cases that I chose in the book. There's a lot of dead body images I don't talk about. Why do I gravitate towards certain cases? Also, though, what context I myself am embedded in, and really probing, you know, that I have the tendency when I write to say, we. What does that mean? Who's we? And really thinking that, you know, I am interested in the book, I focus on Western reception of these images. That's the context in which I, you know, in which I am examining these sorts of dynamics. But also that we is quite fraught with a lot of complications. That we is quite contingent. What does it mean for this sort of purportedly Western identity? And I do think there's something important about purported audiences, that images are circulated to particular audiences that kind of understand the coded references within some of these images, the kind of iconography that they rely on, or certain mechanisms of the composition of these images. So there is no doubt that audience is an important component. But also, when we assume particular audiences, what kind of problems exist in the definition of that we, and the contingencies that exist, like who's not part of that we that exists within that we? And I think that was partly why it was so, I don't want to say helpful or useful, but sort of so interesting, I'll say, that a lot of this context of police violence photography in the United States was happening as I was finishing the book project. And I draw attention to some of that in the conclusion of the book. Also, it is like, this is the context in which I'm embedded. How does this help me rethink a lot of these factors, and also rethink my own biases of who counts as we? Which we's am I part of? And the luxuries I mentioned earlier about being able to leave particular contexts, being able to set aside my own encounters with violence when I need to, and the luxury that I have to do that. So I think it's very productive and helpful to encounter one's own biases. And I don't claim I'm without them. I think it's productive to encounter the biases that we have as scholars as frequently as we can. And we're lucky if the projects we engage in take us in a direction to do that, as this did for me. The other kind of thing that surprised me the most was kind of like this dilemma of what counts as political, right, that exists and sort of circulates through a lot of the work on violence. And again, is sort of preconditioned by a lot of these biases of whose stories and whose voices count. But I think that no matter how much I am aware of its existence, it still surprises me. It's like racism. Like, we know it's there, but when we see instances of it, it can still be surprising and jarring to us. So I think I understand it in sort of similar terms. So I guess I could call that maybe like the biases that exist in at the heart of international studies, or at the heart of the study of a lot of these concepts. Perhaps lastly, like the sort of methodological dilemmas that exist with regards to studying these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And I think just the impetus that exists to turn things into data, and the difficulty in developing analytical frames to encounter particular images, given the nature of the images that we spoke about. So after the book was published, and I won't say which image, but I'll just say that I made a personal connection with someone close to someone depicted in one of the images that I discuss in the book. And I think that really hammered home for me the orientation that I tried to maintain throughout the book, that these are real people with real lives and deaths. But I think that it's really difficult to keep that in your mind as you're developing these kind of analytical frames. And it's one reason why I'm really pretty dedicated over the next couple of years, especially to kind of developing more language for visual methodology to add to some of the excellent work that's already been done. I find Jillian Rose's book to be quite helpful on critical visual methodology. But I think there's a lot more discussion and more work to be done on how we navigate some of these issues, especially in the context of those who study violence, atrocity, human suffering, as we've been speaking about. So I think those are maybe some things I found surprising or interesting that have pushed me in new directions to kind of like explore more of how these assumptions structure our encounters with these concepts, and push back on that a little bit, and use the luxury of the positions that I do occupy to push back a little bit more on that on behalf of some who may not be able to, scholars who are in more tenuous positions or contingent positions, or others, the activists, other practitioners who may not necessarily be operating in some of these same circles. So how do we bring some of those voices together toward that end a little bit more effectively?
Yeah. Dr. Octor, Jessica, thank you so much. This was a fascinating conversation and really generative for me, because it's really pushed me to think about new ways of approaching and understanding political violence and how we understand it in the political sphere. But also, there's so much of your work that I want to read and I potentially teach, because I think it's so important to bring about. You know, I'm in the political studies department. I teach, critical international relation classes, gender and IR, race and international politics. And I always want to encourage students to think critically about the type of information they consume, and then put a lens on what we normalize and what we don't interrogate. And I think this visual representation and justification of intervention for me definitely, and that kind of rings true, because I've also published work about how we justify intervention in different places. And I think one of the things that I haven't looked into so much, but I've been puzzled by on a personal basis in terms of how I react to the images I consume, has been this kind of instrumentalization and the political face of visual representation of violence and extraordinary violence and mass atrocities. So thank you so much for your work.
I think that the best work leaves us with more questions than answers. So yeah. It's a great compliment to me that you're leaving with a lot of directions.
Oh yeah, I'm definitely excited to read more, but also teach your work. And so I feel like it was an absolute privilege to speak with you today. I our paths will cross at our next meetings. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And good luck with your upcoming research, and congratulations on everything, all the good things that are on your plate right now.
Thank you so much.